This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, May 22, 2002. In the Democratic Republic of East Timor, I'm Deepa Fernandez. The Bush administration says it'll file lawsuits charging Florida with violating the civil rights of thousands of black voters during the 2000 presidential election. The U.S. State Department names Iraq as one of seven states that support terrorism. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. President Bush arrived in Germany today amidst vast peaceful demonstrations he will probably never see. Jörg Ratsch has more from Berlin.
President Bush will only be in Berlin for 20 hours, but the whole city has been in excitement for weeks. About 10,000 police are on the streets to make sure protesters are not getting too close to the U.S. president. His visit to Berlin is under the influence of the so-called war on terrorism and rumors of a possible U.S. attack on Iraq. These topics are not very popular in Europe. And also, the Texan Bush does not have as many sympathies here as Bill Clinton had when he came to the city 2 years ago. Before Bush proceeds to Moscow to meet with Russian President Putin, he will speak before the German Bundestag. In his speech, Bush is supposed to talk about major questions in European-American relations. For the time being, security measures in the German capital are on the highest level. From Berlin, I'm Jörg Ratsch for Free Speech Radio News.
A U.S. Senate committee voted today to subpoena the Bush administration for information on Enron. Gareth Schweitzer has more from D.C.
The 9-8 vote was strictly along party lines and follows a request from White House counsel Alberto Gonzalez to committee chair Joe Lieberman yesterday, urging the senator not to subpoena the administration. The subpoenas were labeled unnecessary and confrontational by a White House spokeswoman. Committee Republicans said that the White House had promised to deliver material to the panel by the end of today. Gonzalez, however, has refused to agree to a deadline imposed by Lieberman to turn over all requested documents by the end of the month. Senator Lieberman believes he is being stonewalled by the White House in his search for information regarding Enron contacts with the administration as it headed towards the largest bankruptcy filing in American history. In Washington, D.C., for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gareth Schweitzer.
Worker shareholders at Unocal, a California oil company, want to ensure the company invests in human rights. More from John Hamilton of the Workers' Independent News Service.
Pro-democracy activists crashed the annual meeting of the California Oil Company on Monday, protesting Unocal's plans to build a new gas pipeline from Burma to India. U.S. law prohibits new investments in Burma due to the country's abysmal human rights record. According to Zar Nee, founder of the Free Burma Coalition, the Burmese government has a long history of forcing citizens to serve the military.
Now they're using civilians forcibly at gunpoint to build economic infrastructure, roads, natural gas pipeline, all kinds of economic joint ventures.
Zar Nee says the recent release of pro-democracy leader and Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi is a step towards democracy in Burma. But he says sanctions should continue while the ruling military junta remains in power and while forced labor continues. With the Workers' Independent News Service, I'm John Hamilton for Free Speech Radio News.
A new United Nations report says the burden of coping with environmental change will fall most heavily on the world's poor. Susan Wood reports from the UN.
The UN Environment Program, or UNEP, is warning that if market forces continue to drive the global agenda, more than half the world's people could be facing severe water shortages by 2032. UNEP also says more than 70% of the Earth's land surface could be degraded by poorly planned infrastructure, with Latin America and Asia suffering the worst impact. A report launched today ahead of the World Summit on Sustainable Development, slated to open August 26th in Johannesburg, also holds out the prospect of slashing hunger and stabilizing global warming, but says remedial action must be taken promptly. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
Finally, the Democratic primary for Pennsylvania's governor shows the lines between right and left are not always clear. Jamie Graham reports from Philadelphia.
In yesterday's Democratic primary, in Pennsylvania's gubernatorial race, Ed Rendell, former mayor of Philadelphia and former chairman of the Democratic National Committee, beat Bob Casey Jr. Most unions backed Casey, but Casey's anti-abortion stance mobilized pro-choice voters for Rendell. Many leftists refused to support Ed Rendell because of his conviction of Mumia Abu-Jamal as Philadelphia's district attorney in 1982 and his agreement as mayor to ban protests during the 2000 Republican National Convention. Ed Rendell goes on to face Republican Mike Fisher, state attorney general, in November. This is Jamie Graham, the Blanket Man, reporting from Radio Volta in Philadelphia for Free Speech Radio News.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
A mostly white jury found 71-year-old Robert Francheri guilty of murdering four black girls in connection with the bombings of the 6th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama, over 30 years ago. The church was a gathering spot for blacks protesting segregation in Birmingham in the early 1960s. It was bombed on September 15, 1963, just 5 days after the city's public schools were integrated. Jack Hickey was in the courtroom.
If the spirits of the murdered dead require an accounting, then the souls of Addie Collins, Denise McNair, Carol Robertson, and Cynthia Wesley can rest easier. Robert Francheri will die in prison, convicted of participating in their killing, helping to bomb the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, September 15, 1963. Longtime civil rights activist, the Reverend Abraham Lincoln Woods.
At long last, justice in this case has finally worked to its completion so far as the four suspects were concerned.
Chief Prosecutor Doug Jones presented an almost entirely circumstantial case to win the guilty verdict. David Long, a civil rights attorney, speaks about the power of the state's case.
Well, 90% of all cases are based upon circumstantial evidence. I am very, very impressed with the circumstantial evidence presented by the prosecution in this case, largely being based upon words from the defendant's own mouth, coupled with the defendant's pattern of behavior during the relevant period. I believe it puts a compelling story together of a defendant who was very angry about the progress of integration at both Mr. Cherry and his together plan to disrupt the progress of integration by any means necessary, and that they placed a bomb at the 16th Street Baptist Church as a way to instill terror in the community about integration.
Defense attorney Mickey Johnson cast doubt on nearly every prosecution witness. Some of them he humiliated, catching them in lies, showing them to have distorted facts, hidden motives, and generally spoken in a self-serving, face-saving fashion. But Johnson never shook the core contentions of a single witness. The aggregate effect of this pattern of interlocking testimony was to create a mosaic that only left one way to see the whole picture. Community activists and organizational leaders from around the country have followed the trial closely. They speak powerfully about the meaning and implications of this decision. Mary Jones of the Greater Birmingham Ministries contends that we must use this process to deepen our commitment to healing.
Until we sit down and lance that wound, have that conversation, eye to eye, truthfully, honestly, black and white, looking at each other. Until we can talk about that, nothing will happen. There will not be any healing in this city.
Smith Williams of the National Coalition Building Institute insists that,
you know, the black and other people of color in the U.S. cannot end racism. The bottom line is it's going to take white people in America to end racism. But it's going to take a collaboration of folk working together. Because we are in this together. We got into it together. And it's going to take us getting out of it together.
The Reverend C.T. Vivian, the craftiest of elder statesmen from the civil rights movement and head of the Center for Democratic Renewal, eloquently summarizes the essential task in front of us now.
Until this problem is solved socially, it is not solved.
One retired clergyman present suggests that, quote, those who bear the most responsibility for these crimes, the rich and powerful individuals and organizations that benefited from America's apartheid, have never been brought to justice, unquote. Helen Rivas of the Unitarian Church addresses the socioeconomic situation.
What has not changed is that the powerful have worked to keep everybody else still divided and fighting among themselves. Even the bus system in Birmingham, it's hard to get across town from a white section to a black section. The same, we go to different churches, of course, which is something that people are constantly bringing up. And the newcomers and African Americans are often being pitted against each other. And people are saying, these immigrants are taking our jobs.
Ultimately, she argues, progress is impossible whether Cherry dies in jail or in his bed unless people with similar interests can figure out how to work together. The Southern Poverty Law Center released a study last December that showed Alabama's failure to report hate crimes or even to ignore them. The SPLC's Mark Potok analyzes the current trends in domestic terror and cautions against any sense of self-congratulation in achieving this verdict. Political leaders here are still guilty of
whipping up and fomenting public hatred. And these hatreds, as we've learned at the 16th Street Baptist Church trial, very frequently end in death. We need only think of Matthew Shepard of James Byrd Jr. dragged down a road to his death in Texas, of Billy Jack Gaither, a gay man murdered in Alabama a couple of years ago, and the list goes on.
For Free Speech Radio News, from Birmingham, Alabama, this is Jack Hickey.
The Senate looks poised to pass the White House's trade bill. The bill would reauthorize preferential trade status for the Andean nations of Peru, Bolivia, Colombia, and Ecuador. It would also give President Bush the power to negotiate trade treaties without congressional interference. Last night, the Senate killed a last-minute amendment that environmentalists and state legislatures had favored. The amendment would have limited corporations' ability to sue the government for making laws that might limit their profits. Joshua Chafin reports from Capitol Hill.
President Bush wanted fast-track trade authority written into the trade bill to make it easier for him to establish the free trade area of the Americas, a NAFTA-style agreement for the entire hemisphere except Cuba. One provision of NAFTA called Chapter 11 allows investors to sue when member governments make laws that limit their potential profits. NAFTA's critics say that's a threat to the environment and human health. Democrat Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts argued Chapter 11 shouldn't be part of any future trade agreements. Kerry cites the case of a Canadian chemical company called Methanex.
The details are fairly straightforward. In 1998, the governor of California banned the fuel additive MTBE because it has a tendency to leak out of gasoline storage tanks and it's a suspected carcinogen in humans. Methanex filed a Chapter 11 claim on the grounds that the ban diminishes their expected profits. Methanex claims that this public health law discriminates against the flow of capital. They are seeking compensation and almost $1 billion in damages.
Senator Kerry's amendment to the trade bill would have given state and local laws deference in international disputes, but it was killed. Lobbyists for American companies doing business abroad managed to sway 9 Democrats, including California's Dianne Feinstein. Arguing against the Kerry amendment, Republican Senator Phil Graham of Texas said American companies need to be able to sue governments that try to limit their ability to make money.
If you don't protect investment, what happens and what happened before we had these agreements in effect is that American businesses get into these developing countries. They are forced into dealing with corrupt governments. You're going to jeopardize billions, hundreds of billions of dollars of American investment abroad if you adopt this amendment.
Supporters of the failed Kerry amendment to the trade bill say American companies are doing to other countries just what the Canadian Methanex Corporation is doing to the U.S., suing to get around environmental laws. Mary Minette with the League of Conservation Voters.
For instance, there's been a case where the Metalclad Corporation wanted to build a hazardous waste dump in a Mexican province, and the provincial government denied them a permit. And they were able to use the same provision in NAFTA to try and get compensation for that. The feeling of the environmental community is that the environmental laws of Mexico should be respected just as the environmental laws of California should be respected.
The Senate version of the trade bill will go back to the Republican-controlled House of Representatives without the Kerry Amendment. Senator Kerry predicts foreign investors' claims against the U.S. government will soon average $32 billion a year and will increase with the establishment of the Free Trade Area of the Americas. Joshua Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
A new report issued this week by the U.S. State Department accuses seven states of supporting terrorism. Among those nations cited by Washington was Iraq. For months, the Bush administration has threatened to topple the government of President Saddam Hussein, accusing his government of developing weapons of mass destruction. This, as yesterday's Boston Globe reported that the State Department has launched an initiative to have in waiting an Iraqi government that could take control of the country following an envisioned U.S.-led overthrow of President Saddam Hussein. Free speech correspondent Jeremy Scahill is one of the only Western journalists in the Iraqi capital Baghdad, and he files this report.
In the latest escalation of its threats against Iraq, the U.S. has again accused the government here of supporting terror. The State Department report is adding more tension to an already on-edge Iraqi population. This comes as the U.S. has announced it's doling out an additional $5 million to Iraqi opposition groups in an effort to overthrow the government. The idea is to try and create a force similar to the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan. But seasoned Iraqi political analysts like Hassan Hafid say Washington is again underestimating the strength of the government in Baghdad.
Iraq is different from Afghanistan. Iraq is a state, you know, with a well-established government. This government has contacts with many countries in the world, among them Arab countries, of course. They have also the military to defend themselves. Organized military, and they have also rank and file Ba'athists who can be numbered in millions, actually, who are ready to defy and to die to defend their government, actually. It is, for the United States, sort of an axis of evil, but for many other countries, it's not an axis of evil.
Hafid said today there's no question that any attempt at a palace coup would end in failure.
They think that, you know, that the people around Saddam are against him. This is untrue, you know. And this is can't be done at all, you know, because I think the people around him are very loyal to him.
Iraqis already suffer from an unprecedented regime of U.S.-led economic sanctions, now entering their 12th year. While most people say that things have improved marginally here due to increased government spending, they realize that any U.S. attack could wipe that out almost instantly. Majid Al-Ani owns a small shop on Sadoun Street, selling phones and fax machines. Despite more than a decade of economic and military attacks against his country, Majid cannot understand why the American people would support another massive bombing of Iraq.
Why America come to attack Iraq and they prevent? You know, you remember before 2 weeks, I looking for one injection to my son to help his nervous. I search all Baghdad and I find a sample in one friend, a sample, and it is available and it's very cheap outside. And why it's happened? For what? If you have anything against a government, come negotiate, speak. But what about the nation? Each day you find the hospitals, many children die, women's, old men dies, and always they speak. All people speak about shortage of drug or medicine. Big shortage for what? Okay, allowed medicine to come, allowed food to come to Iraq. I don't know what's the problem for that. And all children now in school, they study that America is enemy of Iraq. And this is not good. And if you come to the what happened in 11 of September, we are not with that. We are against to kill any, even the animals. They lost about 3,000 to 4,000 person, but we lost 1 million now.
With each new threat from Washington, ordinary Iraqis see themselves moving closer to the brink of a scenario they know all too well. And while political analyst Hassan Hafid says the regime is firmly in power, he does concede one scenario that could bring the government down.
If the United States and Britain are going to reduce the country to rubble, you know, to kill a lot of people, you know, and attack, you know, and destroy everything, definitely there will not be, you know, people and no regime at all. That can't be happening like that, but it means that sort of they should do a genocide to the whole country.
The United Nations this week announced that a new round of talks between UN and Iraqi officials will convene in Vienna in early July. On the agenda is once again the return of weapons inspectors. And while some Iraqi officials express optimism that an agreement can be reached, they remember that it was this very issue that served as the precursor for massive bombings in December of 1998. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Jeremy Scahill in Baghdad, Iraq.
Citizens of British Columbia voted last week in a referendum on Indigenous treaty rights. Only one-third decided to vote after pressure to boycott from Indigenous groups, churches and human rights organizations, which included public ballot burning. The referendum was a campaign promise from British Columbia's Conservative Premier, Gordon Campbell. Thatcher Collins reports from Vancouver.
Vancouver area activist Russell of the Coast Salish people states why this referendum contradicts the legal basis for Indigenous sovereignty.
My ancestors had never ceded treaty with any alien government. They never gave us reservations when they come in 1879, my country. They created 12 internment camps, POW camps.
In the last year, the treaty process in BC has been stalled by the province as it waits for this referendum. The province maintains a take-it-or-leave-it treaty policy. Another speaker at the rally was Faye Blaney, who was illegally ousted as an elected member of the board of the Vancouver Aboriginal Friendship Centre for her criticisms of a lack of democracy and accountability of the board. She says that there are over 50,000 Indigenous people in the Vancouver area.
And yet, if you look at the organizations, you'll see a small handful of people that sit on the same boards over and over and over and over again. I think that the colonial process has created a situation where Aboriginal women and children are completely victimized, and that nightmare includes a whole lot of violence, a lot of sexual abuse, the marginalization, the complete control of my chief and council over my life and the lives of my children and my family. The corrupt way of doing elections, which I happened to report to the federal government, and they did nothing.
These same Indigenous elites have strengthened their position of authority through the popularity of the anti-referendum movement among labor and church groups. Blaney and Russell agree that the referendum changes almost nothing, while internal conflicts are the most pressing issues. Russell explains.
In the United States and Canada, this part of the world has the most apartheid notions and violations of human rights that are not transparent, they're invisible, how they do it to our people, who are kept in human bondage to the state invisibly, shackled by their mascot governments that they create and solely fund.
Moreover, according to Blaney, the referendum debate has hidden a much more important fight against the government of Canada.
The federal government, I think, was not intervening in a very public way because of the fact that they're also trying to push through the First Nations Governance Initiative and to terminate us, our special status, our land base. And this is where I really take exception myself as an Aboriginal woman who's struggling to end the neo-colonial ways within our community. See, we can't have a discussion about sovereignty when we have an elite structure in place where we have men at the top. The federal government is capitalizing on our oppositional voices and trying to co-opt that in order to attack our sovereignty.
The official referendum count comes in July. Thatcher Collins, Free Speech Radio News, Vancouver.
The Bush administration says it will file three lawsuits charging three Florida counties with violating the civil rights of thousands of black voters during the 2000 presidential election, which ended when the five Supreme Court justices voted George Bush the president. Two other lawsuits will also be filed in Missouri and Tennessee by the department's Civil Rights Division. Sally Watt has more for St. Petersburg.
The Justice Department says the three lawsuits will be filed against Florida counties that violated voters' rights. Only one of the counties has yet been named, Miami-Dade, one of the counties at the center of the bitter dispute that ultimately secured the Bush presidency. Deborah Clark is supervisor of elections in Pinellas County, which includes St. Petersburg. She said she was surprised at news of the suit.
Well, everything I had heard was that none of the allegations could be substantiated. And I'm talking about numerous different kinds of allegations that surfaced after November 2000. So apparently they received information that allowed them to substantiate the fact that there were some issues.
Accusations in the cases include failure to provide assistance to voters with limited English proficiency, discriminatory treatment of minority voters, and purging of voter rolls. Greg Pallast, author of How George W. Bush Stole the Election.
What I'm concerned about, though, is the U.S. Justice Department is run by the guy who is the beneficiary of that illegal action, George W. Bush, and his highly partisan, viciously partisan attorney general. Now, you might say, well, the guy's doing the right thing because he's, despite who his boss is, John Ashcroft, the attorney general, is suing three Florida counties. What I'm concerned with is that this is a game to undercut the NAACP, which has filed suit against the state of Florida, and as a way of undercutting their suit by telling the courts, don't listen to the NAACP, we've taken care of it. Also, they're limiting themselves to three counties as opposed to going after the mastermind of this operation, Catherine Harris. And I just got a letter from Harris the day before yesterday saying she's not to blame, but not denying that people were illegally removed from the voter rolls in Florida. She didn't deny that at all. She just said that it's not her fault. It's the legislature's fault. Whosever fault it is, the Justice Department needs to go after the entire state apparatus, and that would include the governor, Jeb Bush.
The lawsuits place the Bush administration in agreement with complaints of civil rights leaders like the Reverend Jesse Jackson, who complained that minority voters in Florida were discriminated against in the 2000 presidential election.
Well, what they did was that they took specific complaints by individuals and then twisted and turned every case to see which ones they could ignore until they got down to a couple of individual cases. But this is not about individual cases. Those individual cases are the result of a massive computer-driven operation to wipe out thousands of voters off the voter rolls. They were purged. People were purged from the voter rolls on the grounds that they were felons, that they were criminals. It's not true. They were innocent. But it wasn't one person or three people, and it wasn't in three counties. It was in 67 counties.
The Florida 2000 presidential election is the most investigated in the U.S. history. It dragged on for 36 days of recounts and court battles that the U.S. Supreme Court, by a 5-4 decision, declared George W. Bush the winner by 537 votes. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Sally Watt in St. Petersburg.
Free Speech Radio News is produced by Aaron Glantz, headlines editor is Randy Zimmerman, technical director Jade Paget-Seekins, and technical assistance from Kata Mesta. I'm Deepa Fernandez.
I'm Melinda Tuhus in New Haven, Connecticut. I report for Free Speech Radio News because it's where I can tell stories that matter. FSRN can stay on the air only with your financial support. Please make a donation to Free Speech Radio News online at www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org. Or call 510-287-5551. That's 510-287-5551. Thank you for your support.